This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today is the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. A reminder, this show is not live. Up first, we'll take a deep dive on tech trends to better understand cryptocurrencies, blockchains, NFTs, and more.
To find out how these technologies work, where they came from, and why some people think they're going to change the world. To help us through it, we're joined by Aniket Kate, an associate professor of computer science at Purdue University. Thank you so much for joining us, Aniket.
Thanks for having me.
There's a lot to get into here. So I guess we'll start with the topic we mentioned that most people listening know something about or have heard something about by this point in time, which is cryptocurrencies. When did cryptocurrency first get started?
So the term cryptocurrency is fairly new. I would say that maybe the term started to get employed maybe 7 or 8 years ago in the form of Bitcoin as the prominent players were there. However, the concept of performing currency or payment operations via cryptography, via making sure that we have authenticity of those transactions, is fairly old, maybe 90s, where it was initially thought as a something as a helpful tool for banking environment in terms of the products such as digital cash.
What was the initial reason cryptocurrency was created? You said it was as far back as the 90s. I guess I'm wondering what purpose it served then and if it's changed to what it's being used for now.
We are getting surprised with all things. Indeed, in 90s, the idea there was, can we have an environment where we have currencies or we have payment mechanisms available which are complementary to the existing dollar transactions or euro transactions, where our accounts and our payments are not only just maintained on our banking system on a ledger, but in fact, there could have a independent presence where another system keep track of all this information. And in some environment, in a better privacy-preserving manner, so that no one entity, one bank, or one environment can figure out who is performing transaction with whom. So privacy was indeed one of the main driver in early days. But when Bitcoin came in 2009 and actually got started in 2010 onwards, there it was actually came from a different angle where the idea was that rather than having a single government or governing entity making decisions about how the money is spent and how it is created and distributed, can we have a decentralized or distributed control on that so that anybody who wants to become part of the governance of a currency will be able to join and become part of the governance? So that was the one of the basic idea behind Bitcoin was that. And as we make progress to now, there are all sort of different examples that are emerging, including even our own centralized banks all over the world themselves are also considering what are known as central bank digital currency initiative.
How would you explain this to folks who are listening that are wondering, like, what would Bitcoin or cryptocurrency do for them? How useful is it for them in their day-to-day lives?
So one of the key driver in the early days of aspects such as Bitcoin was that it allows one to perform transactions going beyond the geographical boundaries that were present in a manner so that it's not restricted by any sort of centralized agency that could have been present over there. Because it's a ledger that is maintained on the internet, in a way, it could be simply looked at, if I can send an email to somebody, I'm not restricted by any means by, it's not that when I'm sending an email that I have to wait for a day or two for that email to reach there. It is instantaneous process. Or if I send a message, it can be instantaneous process. On other hand, with our existing payment infrastructure, the payments even across the borders or just within system itself can take a significant amount of time. And what Bitcoin and other environment initially offered was efficiency towards performing transactions, where your transaction time it takes to perform your transaction is no longer limited by geographical or other regulatory means.
So you can get something within seconds versus waiting days.
That was the aim, but there's also catch here in that respect. Indeed, I can see the transaction, let's say you paid me, that it is actually getting added to the system in seconds. But if you consider a system like Bitcoin, even to get the transaction get added to the ledger, it could easily take 10 minutes at least if the network is not congested. Or even you may have to wait for longer, around up to an hour, to ensure that such a transaction indeed finish. But that's where a majority of the innovation has been happening in last 7 to 8 years, where currencies beyond Bitcoin are trying to improve this latency to the level of seconds or even milliseconds these days.
Right. Yeah, there's just so many different types of cryptocurrency out there. I keep hearing about new ones getting started. And then sometimes there's fake ones that people get kind of sucked into without realizing. Before we get into some of that stuff, I'm curious, what is it about Bitcoin that has made it arguably the most prominent cryptocurrency out there?
Indeed. So the success of Bitcoin surprised many, and including myself. I remember myself as a graduate student doing my PhDs in this area of cryptography and distributed systems. And this paper came up from an unknown, actually a pseudonym, and whom we still do not know who the author is. And realizing that this is all good. We knew many of things already. The timing was kind of a right for Bitcoin. What helped Bitcoin in its earlier days was this idea that anybody who wants to become part of the governing a currency can join it. They can become so-called miners, if you heard this term. And you can also then perform transactions in such environment. Essentially, there is no, your name never appears on such a ledger. You are only represented there by what is known as an wallet address, which is basically something known as a public key from the cryptography terms, which is a public identifier for you. But you can create any number of such public identifier. So there was also inherent privacy aspect to that was used. Later, how I'll say that, and early 3 to 4 years, the idea was indeed more popular among the enthusiasts with this whole environment of digital currency. But in spite of all the hiccups that Bitcoin saw in the early year, the technology and the underlying concepts found to be sound, and that actually got more people interested into such environment where it offers a nice alternative or a complementary technology to all the things that we are performing today. And many people look today as that as a sound investment. And that got started maybe from 2015 onwards. People also observe that the same technology can be employed beyond finances to supply chain, to track, and all other applications, and that gave even further boost. So that's how I will say the journey started. Initially, it was privacy and the independence of the governance, but later, the stability of the technology is what attracted people.
You mentioned the privacy, and I don't know, I guess I had a misconception. I thought using cryptocurrency would be more transparent. So is the use of privacy a concern for some that, you know, some bad actors might be using cryptocurrency to do things?
So I would like to answer this question two ways, because it's a very interesting question. And I use the term initially for privacy for Bitcoin. In fact, as it turns out now, it is considered that if you're using something like Bitcoin, then your privacy is even weaker than our current environment that we where we use the current our banking systems. Because the ledger is transparent and available to everybody to observe. And there are all sort of linking attacks that have been thought through so that we can figure out which transactions coming from which ID. And then eventually, when you connect the ID in the Bitcoin world or blockchain world to an identifier, let's say outside a blockchain world in our environment through exchanges where we, let's say, convert dollar to Bitcoin. And that link can be employed now to establish all the transactions that you perform in Bitcoin kind of environment. And there are already firms which actually expertise, and they are active for several years now to dealing with this privacy, basically attacking the privacy on the Bitcoin kind of environment. At the same time, there are newer currencies that came up where the aim was to improve the privacy in such an environment so that privacy continued to remain available to the level of our current centralized banking environment, or probably even better than that in some instances. On the other hand, when you talk about the issue of that privacy being used as a hiding place for illegal activities, it's certainly has been a small concern with this environment, but I find that many times it's overhyped, in the sense that even with our current centralized environment, all sort of money laundries and other issues and tax evasion have been equally effective and active. When we look at the digital currency, it's another instrument with its own features and not so nice features. And in general, it has issues, but so far we have observed that all the regulation agencies have been successful to figure out issues when it comes to the money laundering and other irregularities that typically happens in such environments.
I just remember hearing a lot about different companies that get hacked, and then those bad actors will say things like, we need to be paid in Bitcoin if you want your files back.
Yes, so that certainly is something do happens for the ransomware attacks, where your system get hacked and then they ask you for making payment in Bitcoin. As it turns out, even there are examples where the money got recovered from such environment, because if they use Bitcoin as the example, we precisely know where money is going, which address it is going to, and how it is making, transfer in the Bitcoin environment itself. And once you see an exit point, you precisely know where it's going. So they use it, but I don't think that's always going to be the case, that remains their preferred means. So at the same time, I will say that even before or even without Bitcoin, with the standard currencies, such ransomware attacks could be performed, where now they may try to just tell you to perform transaction in a currency, in a foreign currency, and that could be much more a complex issue for an organization to deal with.
Well, we'll be back in 90 seconds. I'm Miriam Sobe, and this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today is the Friday recap, where we revisit a few conversations we had over the last week. Next up, we'll find out how vaccine mandates are faring at the Supreme Court. With us is Brian Dean Abramson, adjunct professor of vaccine law at Florida International University College of Law. Brian, before the break, we were kind of touching upon some of the pros and cons that might be brought up for these mandates. Have you heard specific arguments for and then against these mandates?
Yes, and the arguments primarily are based on the degree of the danger to society. That is a major point that the court addressed. Some of the justices, particularly Justice Breyer, were very concerned about the fact that we have large numbers of people currently being hospitalized or becoming infected with COVID, much larger numbers than we actually had at the time that the OSHA mandate was first announced due to the Omicron variant. While some of the justices who are skeptical of the mandates have pointed out that the mandates aren't really for the protection of people who are already vaccinated, which a substantial majority of the workforce is, they're for the protection of people who largely choose not to be vaccinated and therefore in a position of sort of making the choice as to whether or not they want to have that protection. And there's a question of whether those people are in the sort of grave danger that the government contemplates, or that the statute that allows OSHA to institute an emergency measure contemplates. You know, the statute requires that there be a grave danger, that it be a new threat, and that the action taken by OSHA be necessary to combat that, and that it be feasible economically. And all of those are points that have been challenged with respect to OSHA's mandate.
There's a lot to consider, I think, with all of these things, if you really try to look at it from so many different angles. But I wonder, you know, is there anything the federal government could do legally that would enforce private companies to require, for example, vaccinations for their employers? Or is there a separate thing between like a private company versus a government company?
Well, you know, that is the question ultimately that the court is being called upon to resolve. Historically, when there have been epidemics and pandemics, state governments have been the entities that have stepped up and required vaccination and have imposed various kinds of penalties for non-vaccination. So this is the first time that the federal government has attempted to use OSHA as a vehicle through which to mandate vaccination in the workforce. And that's why we're at the point of having a controversy, because it's been discussed before. Is this something that the federal government has the power to do? But it's not something that we really know that they do. There's a 1905 precedent, Jacobson v. Massachusetts, which says that the state government does have the power constitutionally to mandate vaccination of the population. And recently, some people have begun looking at Jacobson not necessarily as an empowering case, but as a limiting case with respect to the federal government, saying it gave the states this power, therefore the federal government doesn't have it. That may be reading a bit much into what Jacobson intended, but certainly in order for the federal government to be able to act, there has to be a source of power that can be found in the Constitution. And in order for an agency to act, there has to be a source of power that can be found in a federal statute that empowers that agency. And the questions exist: is it constitutional for the federal government at some level to mandate vaccination for people who aren't directly under its control, like the military? And do the statutes that enable OSHA to carry out its operations and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to carry out their operations enable these respective agencies to impose a vaccination mandate on people who are under their coverage?
Is there worry at all that you mentioned this Jacobson versus Massachusetts kind of setting some precedent? Is there worry that if something were to pass in that similar vein this year, let's say, it could set precedent in the future for folks to be forced to vaccinate against any and everything that comes out?
That is also one of the concerns that the Supreme Court raised, not so much in terms of the precedent that it would set, but in terms of the question with respect to COVID-19, is this really a temporary measure? Is this really a temporary measure directed towards this emergency that is going to kind of evaporate once there is no longer an emergency? And how do we decide when the emergency is over? There's certainly every indication that COVID is not ever going to go away entirely. It will ideally or hopefully become something that is manageable, like the flu. And of course, we deal with influenza by having an annual flu shot. There are a lot of people who are concerned that, well, if we institute this as an emergency measure, we're going to end up having a regime where the government requires everyone to have a flu shot every year. Certainly, there are industries that do require that. A lot of hospitals require their employees to do that, but not a general industry, not in manufacturing, for example. So the justices did express a concern that, are we really talking about a temporary measure, or how do we know that this is going to go away at some point in the future, that we're not giving the government a permanent power to dictate this aspect of people's lives? And that is a legitimate concern. There certainly need to be constraints. I think OSHA can point to the fact that they had a temporary emergency measure for just the healthcare industry that expired after 6 months, as these emergency temporary measures do, and that on its expiration, they said, well, we can't enforce this anymore, and they didn't try to renew it or continue enforcing it. But I don't know that that is something that will persuade justices who are concerned that if we establish this as a federal power, it will just be something that endures without any limitation or any endpoint.
If you're listening live and have any questions or comments on our topic today, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Brian Dean Abramson, adjunct professor of vaccine law at Florida International University College of Law. Brian, one thing that I've been wondering, too, is how are these things, you mentioned something about enforcement, how are these things going to be enforced if they do pass?
That is another, that's another issue that I think a lot of people haven't talked about. And the fact of the matter is, OSHA as an agency does not have the resources to enforce a vaccination mandate governing all companies of over 100 employees. It's an enormous number of companies. They're not going to go and do spot checks or inspections or things of that sort. It's just impractical. So OSHA would be relying primarily on one of two things, either whistleblowers, employees within the company who report to OSHA that they feel unsafe because they think the company is not carrying out the measures that it is required to carry out to protect their safety, including vaccination, and incidences of actual COVID-19 infection outbreaks in particular places. So if OSHA becomes aware that there's a company that's had a large outbreak, they'll figure out pretty quickly that it's likely that there are unvaccinated people in that workforce. And those would be the mechanisms that OSHA would use. Outside of that, you know, it's really not something that OSHA has the ability to enforce as society-wide. It's a matter of companies complying because, you know, they're trying to obey the law or comply with what has been passed down to them as good practice. And it's very similar with CMS. There are an enormous number of Medicare and Medicaid recipients. They are required, or CMS is requiring them, to provide some data about their vaccination rates. So that's a bit more forward than what OSHA is doing. But again, if an institution is not complying, then CMS is going to rely on people within the institution or on news of outbreaks happening or things happening that bring it to their attention that the vaccination rates in that place are not up to what they're supposed to be.
Well, what are the consequences of not complying with either OSHA or CMS mandates?
That is another significant distinction between them. OSHA mandates, if the company is found to be non-compliant, OSHA has the power to fine them. The fine is about $13,000 per instance and can be multiplied by 10 for a willful disregarding of this requirement, which can, for a company with a large number of employees who are unvaccinated, theoretically add up to a very large amount of money. Although, again, it's not known how OSHA will initially respond to potential breaches of compliance. They very often, OSHA, when it deals with a company that is in breach of some other OSHA requirement, whether it's how the wiring is insulated or whether they have scaffolding to prevent workers from falling to high places, the company will initially get a warning and then have an opportunity to cure that defect and then possibly have a smaller fine before OSHA uses its full authority to implement fines. And the same thing is foreseeable with respect to an OSHA vaccination mandate. If you have a company that has a relatively minor lapse that is making some effort to conform with it, but is falling short in some aspect, OSHA might just say, well, we're going to issue a warning. And if there is an injury that occurs or something comes of that, might issue a small fine before going to the full $13,000 per incident fine. CMS is very different in that CMS is providing the Medicare and Medicaid dollars to hospitals, and the penalty that would be imposed for violation of that mandate would be that CMS would deny those funds to that institution. And it, depending on the institution, that can be an enormous percentage of their income. It could be 30 or 40% of the revenue of a given hospital may be Medicare and Medicaid funds. So that is substantial. And that is also something, you know, I don't think that's something that weighs in the consideration of the court in deciding whether these mandates go forward. The court did seem more favorable towards the CMS mandate because it's the government deciding how to spend its money.
With regards to the mandates and the hearings, can they be modified at any point, or let's say like questions arose, can they, the folks that are putting these mandates together, can they change them up, or would they have to go back to the drawing board and then come out and bring them again?
That is a good question, and it's also something of an unknown. This regulatory back and forth between the courts and the agencies is like a waltz, and it's a waltz that we have seen danced before. There have been numerous instances where an agency has come out with a rule, aspects of that rule have been challenged in court and found to be improper, unsupported by their statutory authority, or untenable for some other reason. And then the agency has gone back to the drawing board and issued a new or different rule that conforms with what the court has said and is therefore able to go forward. And that is a possibility with respect to both of these mandates. It depends on the reasoning of the court. If the court does stay one of the mandates or either of the mandates, if the court does that because there is some specific deficiency in the way the mandate is structured. One of the issues that came up, for example, with respect to the CMS mandate was that CMS oversees a lot of different kinds of medical providers. There are hospitals, there are long-term care centers, there are ambulatory care centers, and each one has a statute or statutory language which says this is how CMS can oversee the operations of this kind of entity with respect to determining whether they will receive these funds. And some of these have language saying that CMS can ensure the health and safety of patients being treated in these places. And a few of them don't have that kind of language. And it was brought up before the court, Justice Barrett noted, about 97% of entities falling under the CMS mandate do have this kind of language, but it's questionable for the 3% that don't, whether they actually are under the authority of the CMS to say we're going to impose a vaccination mandate. So if the court decides that CMS can only impose such a mandate where they have a statute that specifically says, for example, with respect to long-term care centers, that Medicare and Medicaid dollars can only be given to places that are ensuring the health and safety of their patients, then CMS may have the authority to impose the mandate there and not for kinds of places that don't have that kind of language. And that might be a restriction that the court says we're going to put on this statute, or we're going to put on this regulation. We are going to stay its operation with respect to those entities that don't have that kind of language. The OSHA mandate is a bit different. The issues really are with the size of the businesses that are being imposed with this regulation. And if the court does anything that's sort of a partial measure and says we're going to stay it with respect to some kind of business, it may be, for example, with respect to businesses that have over 100 employees but don't have over 100 employees working in a particular facility. I think that's somewhat less likely, but it's certainly not outside the realm of possibility, or not outside the realm of the history of what courts have done in shaping stays of regulations in the past.
Well, we have about 2 minutes before break. What kind of timeline is the Supreme Court on? Do we know when the next thing is supposed to come up?
That is interesting, because the justices asked during the proceedings whether the litigants thought that there should be an administrative stay while the court decides the matter. I frankly would have expected the court to have come out very quickly with a determination on a stay. I was anticipating that it would come out yesterday, and it did not. And the fact that it didn't also speaks a bit to the care and concern that the court is taking in deciding this matter. They did not provide an administrative stay, so they're not concerned with the fact that these mandates technically are going forward while they contemplate the question of the stay. And it may be a few more days or a week before they actually come down with a decision on that. There's no precedent, again, for determining how long the court should take to institute a stay. That's something that, you know, is normally not done through this kind of proceeding. But clearly, the justices are going to be writing extensively on it. There are going to be multiple opinions. There are going to be people who agree and disagree. And they're probably going through sort of a negotiating process where they go back and forth deciding what these opinions are going to say and who's going to join which opinion.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, Brian. We'll definitely keep in touch and see where this leads. Real quick, are you thinking this might come out one way or the other? Do you have any sort of feeling towards this?
My gut instinct is that the OSHA mandate will be stayed and that the CMS mandate will be allowed to go forward, but maybe curtailed in some respects.
Thank you so much. Brian Dean Abramson is an adjunct professor of vaccine law at Florida International University College of Law. We'll be back after a quick break. If you have any questions or comments for the show or wanted to get in touch with us, you can always reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe, and it's the Friday recap where we look back at some of our favorite conversations we had this week. A reminder, this show is not live. For our final segment, we'll learn how a school district in South Bend plans to use its portion of the $3 billion in federal relief funding coming to Indiana.
We're joined by Karima Fowler, Chief Financial Officer for the South Bend Community School Corporation. Thank you for joining us, Karima.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So far in the show, we've been speaking with our education reporter about what this new federal relief funding is, but we wanted to talk to someone to get a sense for how it might affect a specific district in Indiana. How much money are you getting at the South Bend Community School Corporation?
We're getting a total of about $93 million.
$93 million. That sounds like a lot to folks who are probably just tuning in, but I don't know, does that not even go a long way for a school district?
It's a shot in the arm. However, once you break it down per student, it's not as much as you think it is. And then there was a small portion of that went to our non-public schools as well.
What was your reaction when you first heard about this relief funding?
My reaction was that it's funding that would be funding that's much needed and would be put to good use at such a time as this.
Before we talk about how you plan on using these funds, can you tell us about your district and the community there?
Our district is about 70% free and reduced lunch. So we have roughly over we're a little under 16,000 students. We have a high minority population, ELL and migrant population. And a lot of those students were already, behind. And when you couple that with some of the other challenges that we faced during COVID and not, initially having all the access that they needed from the onset, it's been pretty difficult. We dealt a lot. That's why I said the money is definitely a tool that was needed. I would say we dealt early off with just meeting the social emotional supports bridging the digital divide and helping them get access. So first you start there and you start with food and then everything else after. So it's been challenging. We've been able to make the pivot pretty well just because we were already working on what some of our virtual options would look like. But it's still been difficult and very challenging. Given our population, and even when we chose to still serve food while kids were out of school, even that was difficult given the population of, our employees who actually go out and do this work. We would have our food service department, the entire department, basically down at one time. So it's been very challenging.
It sounds like, when we talk about funding and schools receiving this money, maybe there's, I don't know if I would say like a stereotype or something where the schools that have all this access, it sounds like they're just drowning in money. Whereas other districts, which have been dealing with lack of access and equity this whole time, this was just maybe a drop in the bucket.
I agree, because we had just went for a referendum. because we did not have all the things that we needed in our district. And we were dealing with other losses financially in education in terms of our funding. So we were already struggling with trying to figure out how to fill those gaps. But then you throw something like COVID on top of that, that really, really, those areas where people are really struggling, those gaps really starting to start to widen. So you're correct. I think people think that it's so much money, but when you're starting at, you know, sometimes if you're starting, you know, under zero, is not a lot of money.
What are the plans that you have so far, or do you know how you'll be using the funding?
Yes, we definitely, we broke our funding out, and we basically kind of, we stuck with the different allowable buckets and how the money should be spent. You know, the IDOE made a lot of recommendations, but definitely accelerated learning. So we have before and after school supports. We have tutoring. We're doing a Saturday accelerated learning on Saturdays, the Saturday school. Then we're definitely doing it as much as we can to support our educators and their social emotional health. We are updating our tech and making sure that all the students have one-on-one devices. So a device at the school, but also if they need a device to take home, they have a device to take home as well. For shutting down. And that's pretty expensive given all of the other things that goes with it. Because we've had to give mobile hotspots not only to families, but also to our teachers that didn't have internet. So we've done that. We're working on our infrastructure with technology, but also we have to, while we're doing this at the same time, look at long-term sustainability and how do we partner with others so that once this money is gone, we can continue, because you also have this expectation. And that's what a lot of people don't talk about. Once people get access and they get all of these things, how are schools, once that money is gone, going, now the expectation is there. How are you going to be able to keep that going? So we're also focusing on our partners and who could we partner with right now for long-term sustainability to make this realization of students having a device at school and a device at home and access to the internet long-term. So we're doing a lot with our local city and we have a citywide connection. So we are getting internet into as many households permanently as we can by collaborating with our local city government and putting money together. So that is working really well for us. And we're looking at other alternative options as well. Phones and other things that are out there and new innovations and technologies for long-term sustainability. But then we also want to make sure that kids are safe. And so updating our infrastructure in terms of our filters in the buildings to HEPA, but also looking at how do we reimagine how we reach and teach our students, because I don't think things will ever be the same after this. And then making sure that no student is falling through the gap or left behind, because not only do you have the educational piece, but now you have a technological piece as well, a socio-emotional, an extended social-emotional piece. And we saw that with kids coming back to school after they had been out for so long, it was really hard for them to be in a classroom with each other and cope with each other and be in a structured setting. That was very difficult. And so there's just a lot there. There's a lot. And we don't know what the answers are. But this additional funding does allow us to also try different things that we would not have been able to try, different interventions that we weren't able to try before, because we would have been just too cash strapped to even try anything outside of the box to see what could actually work.
You know, one thing that I've wondered is with technology and bringing in computers for everybody, it seems like that's a never ending cost too. Just, you know, you can get the funding for it, but you know, there's the updates and then things change. And even from my own perspective, when I have a phone, you know, like in 2 years, all of a sudden it stops working, you got to update it. And so yeah. How hard is that on schools when it's like, you want to give everyone the technology, but it just keeps changing and you have to have money to upgrade?
Yes. But that was the point that I was saying about our, once you do that, you know, now there's this expectation that yeah. kids will have these devices, and what do you do for sustainability? How do you maintain that? And that's where those partnerships come in at. And that's why we're partnering with our city. We're also partnering with our local universities to figure out how can we come up with a long-term solution for our students so that we could keep technology and innovation circulating with all the updates, because there is definitely a cost.
I can only imagine
why the partnerships are extremely important right now with this funding.
Because we can't do it alone,
and we know that the issues that have come from COVID, they are community issues, right?
Right, right. I mean, it affects everybody. Were you able to engage with parents in the community about sort of the process or get feedback on what they wanted to see the funding go towards?
Yes, we had town halls. We had several town halls. We had a lot of information. For us, we had a lot of information when COVID came, just because we had just went for a referendum. So we had been out in the community, you know, listening to parents and families and seeing what their needs were, not what so much what they wanted, but what were their needs. So we already had a good like baseline of what needs were. We went out and we did community tours, community listening tours. We tried to put out as much information as possible. But I will say this did not go without challenge, just because during the pandemic, it was kind of hard at times to reach people. You know, you weren't going out in the public. You were switching things to online. You know, a lot of times some of the feedback that we wanted from some of the families, we were not really able to get with those families. So we started going to, okay, how can we bring this to, so we started going like to the churches, we started going to the local community centers, and we would have our, where we know people were going to show up, where they were going to show up there for food, like food banks and different, because there's a group of people that you never really hear from. How do you reach those individuals to make sure that their voices are heard? So we did launch a campaign, and we started going out to those locations where we knew people would come. They were coming there already. It wasn't something that we were putting on. We would go there because we knew the people were going to be there, and we would try to give them information and get information. And so we did our best, but it was challenging because you had to do it in a short period of time. All of these, for us, everything had a deadline. We had to submit an application. That application had to go through a process of approval. So all except the first round, there was no application we submitted, but we had to submit an application for CARES 2, ESSER funding 2, and then ESSER funding 3. We had to submit a fully baked, you know, applications of what our plans would be. And so we did not have a whole lot of time to plan out with the amount of money that we were given. We didn't have a whole lot of planning time per se. It was challenging, but the good thing about it is that these plans that we have, they're living documents. So they're not set in stone, and we can go back in and make amendments and adjust those plans as the needs of the corporation changes.
You mentioned that folks can see the spending that you're doing.
Yes. So we have a ESSER funding tracker online. Because of, you know, everything with all the money and what everyone's hearing about the money, and we felt it very important to be transparent about the money we were receiving and what we're doing with it. So we have a CARES funding tracker online, and it's broken out by supporting educators, accelerated learning, and sustainable innovation, tech, and other infrastructure. And you can go online and track that spending We update that every single month. You can go to our website at South Bend Schools, sbschool.com.
And so when it comes to some of the biggest challenges your district has faced in recent years, were any of the challenges things that came up during the pandemic that either weren't there before or just weren't as much of a problem? And I mean, I wonder if it's even a fair question when we're talking about equity and access and where some schools were just so much farther behind in access than others and when the pandemic hit.
That's true. Yeah, I'm not even sure of that. Yeah. I agree with you. I don't know that it's a fair, I don't know that it would really be a fair question, because what we saw in the pandemic is basically whatever you saw in the pandemic really just exposed what was already there.
Yeah.
Is how I see it. A lot of times these things existed, but if you didn't have the proper resources to fix it, it just existed, right? And I think governments just worked on, you know, with what they had, and they continued to plug away on, you know, doing the best with what they had and the information they had at the time. And I think the pandemic just exposed what was already there.
What are you hopeful for as we head into 2022?
My hope, what I'm hopeful for, I think there's been so many things that was already there that has really, and so many gaps that has really been exposed to the point the issues have to be addressed. I mean, they have to be addressed, and they have to be addressed head on. The one thing about the pandemic did not discriminate against anyone, right? So everyone kind of got to feel the same thing. So, you know, maybe families that weren't used to certain experiences, now they're able to put themselves in another person's shoes. And I think only good can come from that. I think only good can come from that. I think the pandemic has been a real true testament to our resilience, our resilience as people in the educational community, our resilience as, you know, educators. And I really look forward to what's to come, because we've all had to think outside of the box. None of us have been exempt. We've all been uncomfortable. We've all been stretched. And I think sometimes that's necessary. And I think we do have to reimagine how we reach and teach our children. And I think right now with the pandemic, that has changed the tide. I think there's a lot of work ahead of us, and no one should be shying away from that. There's a whole lot of work ahead of us. But I think the pandemic has pushed everyone in ways that, you know, just it wouldn't have happened pre-pandemic.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Karima Fowler is Chief Financial Officer for the South Bend Community School Corporation. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our Managing Editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.